Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, Blog Talk Radio. This is September 17th, 2022.
don't look for anybody out here to save you other than yourself. You know, even Christ said that. He said, what I do, you can do and greater, and what you sow, you shall reap.
That's Matthew, what's that, Matthew? No, that, sorry, John 14:12. Julian, how are you today? Nice to have you back.
I'm fine, thank you, Russell. Thank
George
you.
George said, he said it all. That's your whole show, he said. Listen.
Yes.
That's the whole show, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. I agree with him on that.
Listen, you know, we talked about you being an Anunnaki, coming here 40,000, 100,000 years ago. So I want to talk about your experience when you came here 40,000 years ago. Do you remember any of that? Because you say you've been in and out of this existence.
Oh, yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Describe it.
Let me separate the two. When I came as an Anunnaki, I was in what you might call the immortal life cycle, celestial time, extremely long living, no dying. 4,500 years ago, when I was killed in Peru, what is now Peru, I have been since that time, for the last 4,500 years, doing normal earth human reincarnational lives. So it's a different time scale altogether. After Atlantis, first there was Atlantis and Lemuria. Then that went away. Then the first time after Atlantis that I remember coming back to this planet was roughly 400,000 years ago. And I remember very distinctly going on a day trip to East Africa, where we were looking for a place to build the new science research center and laboratories. And that was a day that's a wonderful memory for me. It was a distinctly outstanding day. After that, something happened to me. I don't know what. I somehow managed to get myself killed or destroyed in some way. And it was at that time, prior to that, I had not been a true Anunnaki. I had been with them for a long time, but I was of a different race to them. And therefore, although I looked like them, I was a humanoid and I looked like them, I actually had a different kind of body, a destroyable body, let's put it that way. After that destruction that occurred sometime after that 400,000 year period, they adopted me into their race totally. And I was reborn, actually reborn to one of the Anunnaki mothers. Her name was Anar, and her husband was called Marcus. And he was a physician. My father was a physician. And we lived on in a place called Urtikir in the Sirian system. When the planet went traveling by, we went on that planet, the traveling planet, the crossing planet that everybody calls Nibiru, right? I don't even call it Nibiru. I call it Nidra. But anyway, I came back to Earth at that time. Now, that was about 14,500 years ago, and it was right at the end of an ice age. And, you know, you get into an orbit around a planet, as a landing orbit, where you're going to start reducing speed and doing all the other things so you can come in for a landing. And that particular landing orbit was at 15 degrees of latitude, I believe. Anyway, we were already on our way down, and there was takes about 96 hours to do this, and there was a sudden massive overnight thaw, and we were landing in the Aegean. And the snow, instead of being a solid 2 feet of ice to land on, it just disappeared. And all we were left with were these black basalt rocks sticking up, sharp, pointy rocks sticking up. There were 12 of the small landing craft coming down. My elder brother, who was a commander in the Air Force at that time, he was actually in charge of us. That's how I got a ride down to the surface. I was only, I left my parents on the ship, big ship, and I was only supposed to be coming down for like a couple of days and then going back. We were just bringing down some supplies for the base that was on the coastal line of the Aegean, and they would take it over into the Shimmerian, the Nile Valley, the Tigris Valley. And so when we landed, all the small landing craft were damaged, and there were no facilities at that time to really the way they needed fixing. The technology was not developed on the planet at that time, not to the extent where they were building spacecraft. They were doing rockets and regular rockets and flying them off to the moon with gold and then onto the Mars base to take home. But down on the planet, particularly where we were in the Aegean Sea, there was nothing to give us a good fix. We missed our path to get back out. You know, you can only get certain windows of time when you can go back and pick something up in space. And we missed our window, and none of us got to go back. We were all then stuck on the planet. So after 2 or 3 years on this planet, it was decided that we would simply be integrated into the existing community of Anunnaki. Up to that time, we were living in a cave. And at that time, we had, in order to go and join the whole community and make sort of permanent plans to stay on Earth for a long stretch, we had to go through a densification process. And I can remember that like yesterday. The place they built was like an octagonal log building. Yes, an octagonal log building. And in the center, there was just this metal table that you laid on, much like when you go for an X-ray. And all on the 8 panels of the wall, there were light glass panels that lit up one after the other. And they had, as they lit up, there was a tonal frequency went with them. And the frequency got higher and higher and higher as the tonal sound dropped. And the light coloration went from just an off-white through to a dark blood orange color, almost a red. And as it went through into that red to the lower, heavier frequency, you simply, it densified your body. It densified your bone structure. The problem for Anunnaki when they come to Earth, and this has applied to all of them from day one, is that because they normally live either in space or on a planet which has a gravitational field about like the moon, about 1/6 of Earth gravity, coming here, there's a real problem with both heart-lung issues because they have copper, not iron, carrying oxygen through their blood, and there's a paucity of that in the diet here, but also broken bones because of the lighter bone structure. And so that was the first thing I remember having to do, was to get my bones densified. And it took about 3 hours lying on that table. And then when the technician came to get me, I'll never forget the sensation. It was, if you've ever had a heavy, wet swimming suit and you've wanted to go back in the pool and you've pulled on that wet swimming suit and it's cold, clammy and heavy, that's just what my body felt like when I, very unpleasant sensation. I didn't like it at all, but I got used to it, you know, and I continued through that life in many, many things happened in that life. I went to school. I was learning things. I was working at the temple for a long time. As we developed civilization, I worked in the temples and generally I was pretty spoiled. My grandfather at that time was fairly high up in the hierarchy of authority, if you like. And he spoiled me. He took charge of me because my parents were gone on the big ship, right? And I was left down here. So my grandfather took charge of me. And he's the one that I refer to now as David, although that's not, of course, his real name. But I always refer to him as David. and he looked after me. He took care of me, and he spoiled me. He taught me a lot of things, but he also spoiled me. I didn't really do any actual what I would call work until we got all the way up to the Egyptian development, the early Egyptian times, when he and his brother fell out, and he was known to the Egyptians as Thoth. And when he fell out with his brother won the argument and threw us all out. That's when we went to South America, to what is now Peru. We were in that area where we settled. And that was when I actually started getting responsibility for jobs. And one of my main jobs was record keeping. I used to have a belt with five ropes, five thin pieces of like rope made up this belt that tied around me, and all the ends that gave me 10 ends hanging down, and on those ends I did all the record keeping by tying knots. You know, it was rather like having an abacus fastened around your waist, but it was these strings and you tied knots in them as you were going around the warehouses checking, you know, availability of food and supplies and things. And that was my job for a long time. And then from there, we traveled all up and down the South America. We traveled north all the way up through what became the United States, up through what is now British Columbia, all the way up to the Arctic, and back down again across. We went across to Europe, to Gaul, and traveled all over Gaul and England and Ireland and back to South America. We were there for a long time. And in those years, everywhere we went, we built henges, like Stonehenge. That was one of the early ones, Stonehenge. But a lot of them all over are much smaller than that, just small-sized henges. Some of them are big. And taught the local people how to mark things by the stars, understand the movement of the stars and the planets, and how to count time, how to organize themselves in a way that they learn counting and learned for the purpose of harvesting and planting and so on. So that was our job for a long time. David is second to chief scientist of the Anunnaki, but he's also a mathematician at heart. He invented the 52-week calendar as Thoth the Egyptian. That's what got us thrown out of Egypt, because his brother wanted a Ra calendar, a sun calendar, not a moon calendar. And in South America, he wrote the first of the Mayan calendars. He calculated the Mayan calendar for the people. I think, if I remember rightly, some of the people there at that time were known as the Toltecs. I think that was one of the local groups that were there. But anyway, he wrote the Mayan calendar. And that was just what we did. We traveled, we taught. One of the things we evolved about 5,000 years ago was what became, and that was my little thing. It was my job when I traveled with him was to teach the women things like that they didn't already know how to do, you know, because they were living in their own tribal groups. But the gene, the Anunnaki gene, was 5,000 years ago, was spread pretty worldwide by then. It was seeping into every corner of where there were people and bringing them forward intellectually at a very rapid rate. And one of the things I instituted way up on the Arctic Circle was a thing called the Butterfly Society among the indigenous people. And it was a women's society. And it was for the teaching the women, I guess you could say, like being a sorceress, healing things, how to do healing, how to do sewing, how to do all kinds of things, the kind of thing that generally was women's work in those days. But interestingly enough, I would say this, that equal attention was given to both men and women, that they were, in the Anunnaki hierarchy, men and women have always been of equal status. And the only reason that women are taught something different to men is because women have maybe got more ability to learning certain things. For instance, generally speaking, women find handicrafts easier than men. So basket weaving, knitting, sewing, net making, these kinds of things, generally speaking, come easier to women because they seem to have more dexterity with their fingers. Men, on the other hand, do better with the big things like hunting and dressing out beasts because they're physically, chemically stronger. But it's not about one being superior to the other, not in the Anunnaki hierarchy. They're of equal status, but generally the men take the lead. The women do not always follow, I can assure you. So they have, that's one thing they do have, is absolute equality between male and female.
Okay. The thing I'm confused about just a wee bit is that when you crashed, who was here when you crashed? Who did you interface with?
Oh, the Anunnaki were here.
Oh, they were? Or they had been,
oh, yeah.
How long
they've
had they
been here? A long time. They've been here part of a million years or more by then.
Okay.
A long time.
So you just, when you crashed, so you just got off the ship and interfaced with them and say, hey, listen.
Yes. What there was in the Aegean, on the coast, right, of the Aegean Sea, on the left side, that'd be the west coast, right? There's still today a fishing village called Iriba. And Iriba was the original settlement of the Anunnaki when they first came. And it is also the starting place of the mythological creature Poseidon. We all know Poseidon with the trident, right? Coming out of the sea. And Aphrodite rising up from a seashell, right? Well, those stories started when the Anunnaki first arrived because all the original landings were done in the Aegean Sea. The Anunnaki are great submariners. Their planet is a hugely water planet, and they are wonderful submariners. You know, they designed the Ark. Noah's Ark for Noah, that was a submarine. So that, you know, the water could come right over it and it wouldn't sink. It was fine. All right. So those stories about Poseidon coming out of the ocean with a, you know, a fish suit on, well, that was just like a, like you would wear a suit if you went diving, right? Because you're coming out of your ship from under the water. You're not landing on the surface. You're landing on, then, those ships that first came were landing in the sea. And the reason for that was because these ships were the first ones to come to this planet to get the gold. And the original plan was to siphon it out of the ocean. So they came with submersible ships. The ships landed under the sea. They still have underwater bases. Lake Titicaca is one. That Marduk built the Lake Titicaca when the rest of them went home. He built a city under there. They have, the Anunnaki have underwater cities. Maybe they've been long abandoned. I don't know at this point which are operational and which were abandoned. I don't even know if any of them are operational. But that was not uncommon for the Anunnaki to do things underwater. They were just as capable of doing stuff underwater as on the land. And so that place on the west coast of the Aegean is still a fishing village today. You can find it on a map, and it's called Iriba. Now, in the Sitchin translations, he speaks of their original location as Eridu, right? Well, Eridu is really Iriba. The B and the D are backwards in pronunciation, and U is pronounced as an when it's at the end of a world, so end of a word, so Ariba, right, is the same word as Eridu, which is Sitchin's translation in
right.
his book. And that original place was just a log, like a log fortress that they built. And then they moved from there when they decided the ocean was no good and they wanted gold. They moved their base from there to the location between the Euphrates and the Tigris, right? And that's where they began the total development of a civilization which we came to know as Sumeria. That's where they built the civilization.
So then you went to Egypt, then you went to Peru. What was it? How do you, the pyramids, why are they there, the pyramids?
The only pyramid that the Anunnaki built is the Great Pyramid of Giza, and they built that as both a power station, right? It drew in light at the top, sunlight. It was a giant, like you have a voltaic panels on people's roofs today to make electricity for the house, right? Well, they had a great crystal that sat on the top of the pyramid that drew sunlight and created massive amounts of electricity that they powered the city with. So it was, number one, it was a powerhouse. It was also built in the location it's in and with the north-south orientation it's got. And it stands up above everything else, of course, because it's in direct line. If you look at a map, you will find it's in line with Mount Ararat. So you had Mount Ararat, you had the Great Pyramid of Giza, and to one side you had the Cedars of Lebanon, northern Lebanon, where the great landing platform was. And then south of that you had the Sinai Desert, where the control tower was, where the signaling station was, if you like. So Mount Ararat and the Great Pyramid were like two markers that you could see when you were in orbit and coming into land. That kept you in your channel, in your correct alignment for landing. And you came down with those, one on your left and one on your right, and you come right down in the middle and you land in northern Lebanon. And
all right.
Roughly, I'm guessing the distance is about 400 miles from
Let me ask you a question,
the pyramid to Lebanon.
So all the pyramids that are built across the world, I mean, there are pyramids in Peru, there are pyramids in Egypt, there are pyramids in Europe, if you will.
Right.
South, others in South America and the various countries. And all of them are landing what?
No.
Why are they there?
The Great Pyramid of Giza was built by the Anunnaki. Subsequently, when they handed over rulership to men wanted to reach the gods, small g. They considered them to be gods because of all the stuff they would do, and they were so big, right? They were like nearly twice the size of your average human in those days, and they could do all kinds of things, right, that humans couldn't do. So they thought they were godlike, and they referred to them as their gods. They worshipped them, so on and so forth, right? Which is okay. I mean, we'll meet many gods on the way to the true source, the true God. It will take us a long time to get there. And we're going to meet many magnificent creatures who can do things that we can't do as we move along, as we progress, right? But the Pyramid of Giza is the one the Anunnaki built for the reasons I've given you, power station and signaling point for bringing in ships, right?
How it all began. It is possible to travel through time and space and visit long-lost civilizations. It is possible to speak with those long dead and relive again with them their lives and their deaths. It is possible to travel backwards hundreds, even thousands of years to explore the past. I know, because I have done it. Not once, but hundreds of times. I have done it with regressive hypnosis. This is a technique or method that allows people to remember and often relive their past lives. The idea that we live not once, but many times is called reincarnation. This should not be confused with transmigration, which is the mistaken belief that man may be reborn as an animal. According to my research, this does not happen. When the soul of man incarnates, it will always inhabit a human body. He may, unfortunately, sink so low as to become animalistic in nature, but he will never take the form of an animal. This is an entirely different type of spirit. I don't know why some people find the idea of reincarnation so hard to understand when they can relate it to their own lives. Everyone is constantly changing. Not to change would mean you have stopped growing. At that point, you become stagnant and start to die. We change so much that many times we may feel as though we have lived many different lives in this one. We go to school, marry, have children, sometimes marry again. We may change occupations, sometimes going in an entirely different direction. We may travel or live in a foreign country for a while. We may experience trauma and sorrow with the death or unhappiness of loved ones. We hopefully learn to love and attain our goals in life. Each of these are stages in our lives, and they are totally different from the other. We make mistakes and hopefully learn from them. We hear people say, "I don't know how I could have done such dumb things when I was younger. It's almost as though it happened to someone else. I know I could never return to the young teenager in high school that I once was. I would not even be able to relate to her, so naive and shy. We would not have anything in common now. And she would have never been able to understand the complex person I have become. Yet we are one and the same person." This is the way I look upon past lives. We know we live them, just as we know we lived our childhood. They could be called the childhood of the soul. Hopefully we have learned to apply the knowledge we have gained through hundreds of years of making mistakes, of being human. But just as there are people who take longer to grow up, there are also people who must live many lives before learning even one lesson. We can look upon our own bodies as a form of reincarnation. We know our bodies are ever-changing. Cells are constantly dying and being renewed in a never-ending cycle. We certainly don't have the same body we had 10, 20, or 30 years ago. It has changed for better or worse. We can see reincarnation as a school for the soul, a series of lessons and grades to be learned for our education and growth. Then we can stop cursing the bad times that often befall us and learn to think of them as tests and exams which we must pass or fail. We can't change what has happened to us in this life or in others. We can only learn from it and go forward, letting the past guide and teach us.
I'm sorry, I played that just a little too early. I'm sorry I interrupted you, but I hit it by mistake. But you could relate to that because you were an Anunnaki when you came here. You went to Peru. You went to Egypt. And you remember all of that. Now,
yes.
What she says is true, that you've been in and out of this world a number of times. How many times do you think you've been in and out of Earth's existence?
Well, as an Anunnaki, I've been here. Well, I was here as an Atlantean associated with the Anunnaki, and then I returned as an Anunnaki 400,000 years ago, and then again 14,500 years ago. And those are continuing lives. And that 14,500 years, for the first 10,000 years, you might say, was one life. It was only one continuous life.
One
then
life?
The last 4,500 Yes, that's right. Anunnaki don't die like we do. They have a different body structure, and they last a very, very long, long time.
Okay.
I mean, their rulership on this planet, the kings normally ruled for about 30,000 years in each taking their turns. 25, 30,000 years was quite normal for them to rule.
Why is it changing so much then? 35, to live like Methuselah lived, right, 900-some years, our time, why are we not living, and why did you come back and live the little short life of 80 years instead of 800 years? Why?
Well, because we've deteriorated physically. The food we eat, the environment we live in, all the things that we know that are damaging to the body, we simply deteriorated. And this kind of deterioration comes about with large increases in population. You know, wherever you get high densities of population, and this is a generalization, I know, but you tend to see more diseases because people are close together. And they spread diseases more easily. And so, you know, just common sense tells you that the more people you get, the more diseases you're going to have that are going to be killing people sooner and sooner and weakening their immune system. And everything that we've done environmentally has weakened our immune system generally. So we are simply not as healthy as we were. You know, there was old Abram wandering around the desert producing new babies in his 90s, right? And walking hundreds of miles with his sheep across hot desert country. Well, none of us could do that today, I don't think. I doubt you'd find one in 10 million people who had that kind of vibrancy. They'd have to be, you know, Tibetan lamas or something to actually be able to do that today. So we've deteriorated.
Are we going to get back to that on this planet, you think?
We're trying. We are trying.
What would help us to
Every
do that?
Effort is being made. Well, for one thing, we have arrived at the level. Can I just go back a minute to where we were, Russell, because I can't get it out of my head. I hate to leave things unfinished, and then I'll come back to this.
Okay. Okay.
So I want to go back to what we were saying about the pyramids, because I think people need to understand this. The pyramids that you find through South America, Mexico, and various other locations in the world, the original ones were built for two reasons. One, they were a high-rise structure, and in the lower levels, there were great storage chambers for food, etc. And on the top level, you had like a mini palace where the, quote, local god lived, the local Anunnaki overlord lived. And on top of that, or in the center of that, you had a launch pad for his personal spaceship. That was at the time that the Anunnaki were living and running things on the planet, thousands of years ago, right? After they left, roughly 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 years ago when they first left and came back for a bit and did a bit more. So it's a few thousand years, right? When they finally left, the local people across all nations and in all countries tried themselves to copy the Anunnaki. They wanted to be like the lords, right? And so they built their own copies of the original to the best they could. This is why the pyramids in Egypt, except for the Great Pyramid of Giza, they don't balance properly. They have, you know, bulging sides, or they're uneven, or they didn't stand up very well. They're not perfect because their mathematics were not perfect. And that's true of almost all the pyramids that you find buried in jungles and things to this day, that they are less than perfect structures unless they are the originals. So that's just what I wanted to say about that. Now back to where we were. We were talking about why we have deteriorated. Well, we've deteriorated primarily because we have increased rapidly in numbers and without proper attention. You know, think of it this way, when there were smallish communities of a few hundred people, say 200 or 300, scattered in communities across Europe, the improved gene had spread to them. They were true Homo sapien, but they were still small numbers, just 200 or 300, 400, and they were intermarrying among themselves. Too small a gene pool for healthy gene production. So that was the first thing that was deteriorating us. Then the next thing would be the kind of food that we were eating, because predominantly we were still coming out of the hunter-gatherer age and living primarily on meat. Although we had been taught and developed how to develop agriculture, plant life was not our main source of food. Animals were our main source of food. And, you know, it's an older scene saying, if you take death into your body, meaning dead animals, then death is part of you. So whenever we are eating dead animals as a societal thing to do, which every society does at some point, then we are taking that death into us. We are not taking life into our bodies all the time, but we are taking dead things in. And that in itself has a slow, deleterious effect on our entire structure in some way that I do not fully understand. But I do know that that is an ancient, ancient teaching, and it has some effect, right, over the long term. So then we moved into more modern man, and right up into sort of, well, through the Middle Ages, we had plagues, we had diseases, we had very little medicine, or only the herbal people, and mostly the herbal people were called sorceresses, and they were often burned as witches. So their talents were very much hidden talents, not readily available to everybody. Then we come up into the Industrial Revolution. And from that moment on, let's say for the last 200-300 years, we've had increasingly amounts of devastating pollution in our atmosphere, and our whole environment is now polluted. Radioactivity, frequencies, microwaves, all these G5 things that they put out there for our phones. We can't do without our cell phones, but the signals that we put between our cell phones are killing us, literally. The phones themselves give you brain tumors. So we are destroying ourselves. And the only way we're going to get back to the way we should be, with some level of longevity, up to humans could now probably, it's estimated, be extended a lifespan for 150 years. But it is hoped that it can be taken back up to nearer 1,000 years. And there's no real reason why it shouldn't. When we move into frequency medicine and we have some catastrophic disruption of all our electronic systems so that humanity has a recovery period when it's not bombarded with one sort or another of radioactive frequencies throughout all the electronic equipment that we all use, when that goes away for a period, and when we lose for a period of history things like air travel or cars, gasoline, anything that uses oil, anything that uses petroleum in any way, shape, or form, if we get that out of the way for 200 or 300 years and all these electronics go bye-bye for that same period,
do you think that will happen? Then we will have
a renewed health. Yes, I hope so, because this is what's going to renew humanity.
What is going to usher that in?
Your great-grandchildren, well, I think it's being ushered in now. The WEF, I think, is ushering great disaster in for this planet.
But we have
World Economic Forum, because they're going to be destroying people's lives in the process of what they're doing. And when that comes to full fruition and they destroy everything to the point, as he said, where, you know, you'll have nothing and you'll be happy. Well, people won't like that at all. They'll rebel against it. There'll be civil unrest and upheaval. And with that will come strong-arm government, massive destruction, takedown of the government, and loss of all these kinds of things I'm talking about.
Do you think that's possible? You think that's possible?
Yes.
I mean, when we look around, things seem to be pretty disruptive across the broad spectrum of the whole world, from country to country. And do you think that the people will rise up and take control of the government and change it somewhat and somehow? And if you do change it, what are you going to change it to? And who's going to be in charge of it?
I think they will rise up, right, and protest. How strong their protest will be remains to be seen. But when that does occur, those who are standing up for that which is right, which is individual human freedom, right? I mean, that's the most fundamental thing, that the Creator has given each person a life to experience through on this planet for their soul to learn, right? That's a gift from the Creator. And not Charles Schwab or whatever his name is, or George Soros, or Joe Biden, or any of these other people that are constantly taking away, eating away at all our little freedoms so that there is nothing left. And when there is nothing left, and the people realize it, and they will realize it through the steps the WF wants to take. They want to control all money through the banking system, issue you with some kind of credit system, and if you don't have their marker, you won't be able to access it. Now, that to me is, you know, the biblical 666, the mark of Cain, whatever, right? That you won't be able to buy, you won't be able to sell, you won't be able to live if you don't do exactly what the government tells you, how they tell you, when they tell you, and where they tell you. And when it comes to that point, those people who have been working on their spiritual evolution and are not part of the flock, the sheep that follows the government, they stand even now separate from the government. They don't already agree with what the government is doing, and they're standing up for their individuality, for example, doing things like simple things like saying no to the COVID jab. No, I don't want it and I won't do it, right? These people, the ones who take the time and trouble to do the research, to see what is happening and won't go along with the government's program, and this is global. This is everywhere in the world. It's not just one place. It's everywhere, and it's in different degrees of intensity, right? And we all remember the one man who stood in Tiananmen Square in front of a tank. Well, now you have millions standing up around the world in front of tanks, because almost every country of the world has a government that is now like a tank, and you're like the one individual in Tiananmen Square standing in front of it. But there are millions doing that now. And those are the people who are choosing their spiritual well-being by seeking out truth on all levels and trying to live with those truths. And when they stand up finally against all their governments, that's when the extraterrestrials will say, okay, now you are asking for help, because they will be. They'll be praying every single day, Lord, help me. What can we do? Please help us. And that's when they are giving permission to the extraterrestrials to come in and help them. And who is coming? Well, we know who's coming, because the Bible tells us, the Lord Jesus Christ. He's coming back and he's bringing a big sword, and he's going to cut the heads off all the bad people with it. In other words, he's simply going, you know, we say we believe things, we say we have faith, but mostly we don't. The reality, the truth is that when the time comes, the source, the ultimate creator, has empowered beings in the universe capable of absolutely annihilating all these evil people on the planet in one fell swoop. And it will not be one big long battle when that comes. It'll be lucky if it lasts 24 hours and they'll be done for. Really, really done for. But we have to get to that point ourselves.
Let me ask you a question. Isn't there a rule from the Galactic Command that watches over all the planets in the universe, or many of the planets, because I don't know, all it happen to be hundreds of billions of planets and universes, so it's really ubiquitous. I mean, it's so big that we can't even know what's going on. But isn't there a rule, at least among the Palladians, the Reptilians, the Nordics, the Anunnaki, isn't there a rule that they don't interfere with the lives of a people on a planet? Yes or no?
Yes, but they don't abide by it.
Oh,
none
okay.
of them abide by it.
Okay.
That is
okay.
the rule. That's the reason the Anunnaki are coming back, because they broke the rule, and it's a big no-no, and now they have to come back and clean up the mess they made with the genetic engineering in the first place. They have to fix it.
What was wrong with the genetic repercussions? Okay, what was wrong
with them
interfering with the engineering of the human species? What went wrong with that?
Because the humans on this planet were already evolving. They had, you know, been the well, it's fashionable now to call them the pre-Adamites. You know, there was a hominid species on this planet, already living in tribal groups, Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal, these pre-Adamites they talk about. There were all these different groups living on this planet, evolving, having developed tribal communities, made tools, learning to make tools, generally going through a process of evolution on this planet, the same as they have done on all the other planets for millennia. Every habitable planet has had natural species evolving. The animals evolve, the people evolve. They rise up and they develop, right? But they also go away again. And the Anunnaki basically did the genetic engineering because they needed a labor force to get the gold for them. Their own people had been digging the gold for several thousand years, and they were fed up with it. They were actually using their astronauts. Enki had commanded the Air Force. Now, you imagine if you said to one of our generals, well, now you've got to go and start, you know, growing all the corn that we grow in this country. You've got to get your men in the fields every day and grow the corn. Well, as a matter of martial law, they would do it for a while. But when they've been doing it for 10 or 20 years, they would get fed up and say to the president, we don't want to do this anymore. We're going on strike. Find somebody else to do it. Well,
so analogous to that situation, when the so-called pilgrims came from UK to America to find a new life, new way to find freedom, they decided to go get the blacks and bring them over here and use them as slaves. So they could watch over them, so they could build a civilization. Is that pretty analogous?
Pretty much, yes, it is.
Pretty much, okay.
It really is.
So,
you know, so the reality is that anywhere in the world, at any time throughout history, maybe from the beginning of the creation, for all I know, you've never been able to have a capitalist system without some pool of inexpensive labor, whether that's actual slave labor or low-paid labor.
So the process of using people by the people of the cabal, if you will, the Illuminati, the Bilderbergers, whomever.
Well,
so they are continuing that process,
The process of having an elite group who live very, very well, better than anybody else, and a large mass available for labor, right, is called a republic. That is a republic. The Republic of the United States of America was designed to have an elite group at the top with all these people coming in. Well, you know, the old, the sick, the lonely, they've got nothing, they're down and out. Bring them. That's why it says bring them all to me, because they wanted slave labor.
True.
Bring all the dregs of Europe to America, cheap labor, right?
Let me expand
that's
that a bit.
That's what the Republic is. The Republic of Rome, the Republic of Rome did the same thing.
But some people call it slavery.
The Roman Republic.
Hello?
Yeah.
Some people call that slavery.
Yeah.
Whether you
slavery.
Bring people to Antarctica, as the Germans have done and are still doing, right, or whether you put people on the moon, whether you abduct people and put them on the moon, to put them on Mars, whatever, that's continuing even today, even on underground bases
and
all across.
And it is slavery. It is.
So
a,
is that part
only,
of...
It's slavery as a man. Go on.
So that's a game plan for all entities in the universe. Would you say that, as far as we know it?
It's a system. Wherever you go, you will have low-paid, underprivileged workers. Now, there may be a few planets out there, that, and hopefully Earth will get to this, where you have an ideal planet for living on, like Earth. In other words, the planet itself provides you with everything you need to live. Food, shelter, everything, right? And you have a low population. These are keys, right? These are key factors. A planet that provides everything, a relatively low population, and the willingness of every single person to allow every other person to do nothing but develop their own skills and abilities in the way they see fit, sharing all the necessary commodities that go up to make life. In other words, the food. The problem is that, and I'm not saying there aren't planets like that out there, there may well be some. You might call them utopias if you like. But the problem is that people are never satisfied with only what they need. For instance, how many women in America, for example, or in any of the Western world, absolutely stuffed full, closet full of clothes, they will never live long enough to wear them all out. But they have to have new ones every season, every fashion, new clothes, new clothes, new clothes. So they have closets full of clothes.
And shoes.
Nobody is ever satisfied to say, and shoes, and hats, everything. They're never satisfied
but
to
what,
say,
what is that
I
about?
Need a, you know.
Help
well,
me out, please. Please help me out. What is that
because
about?
Because clever marketing. We have been sold a bill of goods. And that bill of goods has convinced us for years now, for hundreds and hundreds of years, maybe even a thousand, thousands of years. The powers that be who want control over us, who want the wealth, who want the money that they get from producing things that we don't need and then marketing them in such a way that we are stupid enough to keep buying them, and then they get the wealth, and then they get the power, and then they control us. And then, of course, we complain about that level of control. But we're doing it to ourselves. And so
but
long as you
remember
have
the lady Imelda Marcos, I think she had 6,000 pairs of shoes or 3,000.
Absolutely.
Was that
crazy? She had,
but that was,
I think she had 2,000 pairs of shoes, but crazy.
That's a
nobody
wee bit extravagant, isn't
pairs
it?
Of shoes.
I mean, what's wrong with that? What's wrong
and
with
we
us?
We all do it. We all do it. I probably have 50 pairs of shoes. I love shoes. I don't have many clothes, but I love shoes, right?
So if we put you in charge.
George and I knew a couple in Coeur d'Alene. They were friends of ours, and they had a shoe shop. So they used to let me have any shoes I wanted at cost price. Almost every time we went to visit them, I'd get new shoes, you know. But no, it was an extravagance. I know even now, when I have taken my life down to next to nothing, I still have more than I actually need, because now I have things that just because I enjoy them, like my books. You know, I have bookcases of books and things because I like to read. I have a television with channels, movie channels on, because I like to see the movies. But I don't actually need those things. If we went back in our minds to what do we actually need, right? And then built up from there a few extras for pleasure in life, we'd all be a lot better off. And we wouldn't be so easily conned by governments as we are today.
Okay, okay. It seems to me that we are in a difficult place, being here on Earth or Mars or the Moon or Jupiter. How are we going to resolve the problem with all the people starving, lack of food, lack of water, lack of medical care, and we go on and get 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 pair of shoes and forget to try to help feed other people? What is wrong with us as species in this vast part of the universe?
For one thing, I think today a lot of this excessive consumerism, which you see more in the United States of America than in almost any other country I've seen, it's pretty bad, you know, around the industrialized world, in first world, if you like, in general. But nowhere is this consumerism as bad as it is in the United States. We throw away so much that is, you know, still so very usable. But I think a lot of it is because it gives us, buying things still gives us a sense of some control, that we still have some control over our lives. It's an illusion. We actually have little or no control over our lives between the sorry spiritual state we're in, the sorry economic state we're in, and the very sorry state our government is in. There is little in our lives that we actually have control over. But buying ourselves extra channels on the TV or buying ourselves extra clothes to wear, this is a tiny way of controlling or creating the illusion that we have some control over our lives. And right. I think that's why people do it, because they're afraid. They sense the eroding freedoms of society for everybody in the world, that we have so little real freedom left as human beings on this planet.
Okay.
Unless you're in that top 1%.
King Charles III, who's now on the throne, they said the family is worth something like, at least conservatively, $100 billion.
Tis a day of great loss, but Queen Elizabeth II leaves a great legacy. Today the crown passes, as it has done for more than 1,000 years, to our new monarch, our new head of state, His Majesty King Charles III. With the King's family, we mourn the loss of his mother. And as we mourn, we must come together as a people to support him, to help him bear the awesome responsibility that he now carries for us all. We offer him our loyalty and devotion, just as his mother devoted so much to so many for so long. And with the passing of the second Elizabethan age, we usher in a new era in the magnificent history of our great country, exactly as Her Majesty would have wished, by saying the words, God save the King.
God save the King.
Okay, comment.
Well, you know, I grew up in an era when there was no television and we used to listen to the radio, BBC radio, and it shut down at, I think it was 10:30 or 11 every night after the news. And they always played God Save the King, as it was then, King George VI. Mm-hmm. And that was the era I grew up in. And when the national anthem came on, we stood up. We were in our own sitting room, but we stood up while the BBC played the national anthem. In other words, my generation were very, very much raised in that tradition.
Okay.
Excuse me, I've got a tickle. I don't think.
We'll get some water. Get some water.
For me, it doesn't matter which king or queen is on the throne, right? I still would support the idea of the monarchy. And I still would support England as a monarchist state, even though education, inquiry, and research has shown me all the bad things that go on in the City of London and with the royals and everything else. It's not that I am blind or stupid, but it's the principal idea of a monarchy that I support, because what a monarchy does, it has a person, the king or the queen, as one individual who stands between the people and the government. For example, like we had here in this country, we have a government, and the government brought in, let's say, the Patriot Act, and then Patriot Act 2. So once that was passed, if you went through immigration and you were having a problem with immigration and you argued with them, you said something like, I know my rights, meaning the Bill of Rights, they would politely point out to you that the Bill of Rights was set aside with Patriot 2. We no longer have a Bill of Rights. Most people don't really understand what that means to them, but we have no protection. The government owns us and can do what it wishes with us. Make no mistake about it, right? That is not true in England. And it's not true in any monarchy which has some form of parliamentary government and a monarch on the throne. Because the monarch stands for the people, and the armed forces are under the monarch, not the government. The king or the queen in England is the head of the armed forces, Air Force, Army, Navy. They are not controlled by the government, right? I mean, they are in where they're sent and what they have to do, but everything that they do that the government asks the armed force, like, for instance, when Margaret Thatcher wanted to send the Navy to the Falkland Islands for the Falkland War, the Queen had to sign off on it. She has to, or the king now, has to sign off government wants to impose upon the people. And if ever a time came when they did something that took away the freedoms that are built into the idea of a constitution in Britain, and there is no written constitution in Britain, but there are principles laid down. If the government went against those in a major way, the government, the king or queen can dissolve Parliament. Give them all the sack. Make the country have a new election. Send new people. We have no way to do that. We as the people are dependent upon those we send to Congress. But in England, they're not dependent upon those they send to Parliament. Because worst case scenario, the people can ask the queen, we don't want this, get rid of it, and she can do it.
Okay,
she
let me ask you a question.
She was asked to do it twice in a reign, and she wouldn't, but, yeah.
Here's a big question. The big question. In the vastness of the universe, be it Mars, Pluto, Andromeda, and not, and, you know, wherever, are we going to be controlled by a king or a queen or the government continuously, henceforth, now and forevermore? Is that the nature of the game?
Well,
is the nature of the, wait.
No.
Just ask this. Is that what Jesus, Krishna, Buddha, Baha'u'llah, Muhammad, are all these people working for that, for to be in charge of something? For instance, they're getting ready to change the coinage, if you will, the medium of exchange.
What it means for all Americans. The U.S. dollar will be made obsolete. Soon your cash will be confiscated or will simply be worthless paper. The cash currency we have now will be replaced with a new programmable digital token. But the truth is, few outside the deep state recognize Biden's move for what it really is. If my predictions are correct, this is so much more sinister than simply replacing the cash dollar with a new digitized version. Friend, this new currency will allow for total control of all American citizens, because every digital dollar will be programmed by the government. That means they will be able to turn on or turn off your money at will. Not only that, but they'll be able to track and record every purchase you make. This is very different than online banking and has nothing to do with crypto. I'll explain everything in a moment.
So anyway, that's coming. Mm-hmm. Biden just
That's what the WEF is about. I was just explaining it yesterday to my housekeeper and telling her, for heaven's sake,
explain
you know,
it to us.
Withdrawal. Well,
talk to us.
When, first of all, anywhere in the world that a country, and George and I were talking about this for 40 years, we knew it was coming, right? Any country that changes its currency just from one currency to another, you know, a different system, like Britain changed its to decimal coinage as opposed to pound, shillings and pence at one point, on average, you lose between 30 and 60% of the value of the money whenever countries change currency. That's just across the board. That's a generalization. But what they are doing this time goes so much further. They're taking away all your money. And the first step you saw maybe 2-3 months ago in China, when the Chinese central group, ruling party, sent out notice to everybody that now, whenever they had savings in the bank, in a savings account, not a checking account, a savings account, those savings were considered to be an investment in the bank. And therefore, they would not be able to draw them out because the money was invested in the bank and the bank would pay them out in terms of profit sharing, right? So that meant everybody in China who had savings in a bank lost all their money. They've essentially lost it because they can't control it anymore. They can't get to it. So that was a first step moving towards this, saying, okay, now everything you have in the bank will no longer be dollars, right? There'll be no more dollars. We're doing away with paper money. We're doing away with coins. There'll be no more of that kind of money. What we are going to do is we're going to nicely fill up your banking account for you with a number of credits. And we will tell you, yes, you've got 200 credits in your bank, or yes, you've got 500. And it will be some relationship to an exchange for your dollars. If you had $500, they might give you in exchange for that based on the spending power that they decide. But here's the thing, that you're only going to be able to get that money by some technological means, like maybe your fingerprint. You know how I use my fingerprint for passwords on my computer. So we are all already conditioned to do this. When the banks do it and they move it in piece by piece, it won't seem that hard to us. It will seem okay. Well, then the next thing they will want to do is those credits that they've given you, every time you use them, there will be a record of the use of them, because they're not going to give you anything in your hand. It's all going to be either a thumbprint, a fingerprint, a chip in you. Just like you use a credit card today, you don't have the money in your hand. You have an electronic chipped card that reads. So somehow or other, you will be a chip, you personally. And every time you access your credits and use them for something, the government will know about it. And any time they want, they can just close your access to chips down to the credits that you have. They can cut off your access instantly in a way that's not possible now. For example, I was hearing recently that some people out there are predicting an event with our banking system within the next few weeks. I forget where I read it, but I was reading two or three people were predicting that this could happen and there could be a shutdown of the banking system for several days maybe, and that this is in the next two or three weeks. It's imminent, something that the banks are getting ready for, these new systems.
So why would they do that? So why would they do that?
Well, they were suggesting that people take money out of the bank. Well, the point I'm making is that you can go now to your bank and you can withdraw cash. But when it goes to the credit system, there'll be nothing for you to withdraw. It will all be entirely electronic. And so if you are not in the system for any reason, you will have no access to the means to pay for any goods in any way at all.
So it's more control.
If they go,
that's not freedom.
Absolute. This is ultimate control. This is total control of everybody. And when you, it's like, you know, somewhere in the Bible, it tells you if you don't have this mark, you will not be able to buy and you will not be able to sell. And that's the, absolutely the way it's going, as simple as that. Now you imagine if you had no way to buy anything or sell anything because there was no such thing as tangible money, real money in your hand. And the only people who are going to survive that mess and not be in that system.
Your husband.
Or want to avoid. Well,
George,
basically anybody who saves gold and silver.
Here's what George said before he left. Here's what George said before he left.
In the meeting, as we're talking about it, we come back to, as you said, the population problem that we have. And in the meeting, they wanted to what they wanted to do was reduce the world's population down to, as the extraterrestrials said, the Pleiadians themselves said, the planet was originally engineered for 500 million people. Well, that was the meeting. They were talking about the same thing, that they want to reduce the world's population down to 500 million. Now, how did it come personally to me? They asked me to build an enemy prisoner of war camp in downtown Las Vegas. Who's the enemy? So we started talking about it, and the discussion is the planet, and remember, we have a lifespan that's changed drastically over the last 100 years, you know, in the early, around the 1900s, when there was, the population was down, what we call manageable at that time. We're at 8.3 billion on the planet today. In 1900, we only had 2 billion. Can you imagine how we're increasing the population? At any rate, when they asked me to build that enemy prisoner of war camp, my buddy happened to be the Ted Gunderson, the former head of the FBI for Southern California. Anyway, Ted took the contract, come back, and he says, they changed the name. It's no longer enemy prisoner of war camp. It's called FEMA. That's the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And they're building them all over the United States. And that's to get ready for their population reduction. Anybody over age 44 is to be eliminated unless you have a talent that they have. And they only want to have their estimate. We'll be lucky to have 20 million Americans left alive.
Okay. So it seems to be a conspiracy to, how would I say it, to lean upon the people's freedom so they can take that away. Is that what I hear?
Right. Absolutely.
Why?
You know, because, okay, imagine you, just you, in your home where you live, and think about everything you need to have a good life, enjoying all the things that you like to personally enjoy. How many people would it take to serve you to sustain that life? Let's say your home sat in 50 acres of land, for argument's sake. Just 50 acres, no more. And you lived there by yourself, just you. How many people would you need to serve you? You'd need people to look after your house. You'd need people to cook and clean. You'd need people to grow the food in the gardens for you. You probably would have some stock animals. So you'd need somebody to run like a little miniature farm, a, you know, survival type farm for you. You would need somebody to look after your vehicles, repair your cars, take care of it. You'd need somebody to take care of your swimming pool. We're already up to six people. So you can say an average human being needs the services, one way or another, of about 20 other humans. We all draw services from at least 20, probably nearer 50, if we take in all the enjoyment things we do. But direct services to sustain each one. Now, most of us living out there, we buy those services, right? And so we keep all these people and we buy those services. But let's see that the people like you, the one person, the person who is having, let's say there's only 5 million of you. Right, then how many people, if each person needs 50 people, how many people do 5 million need to service them?
Okay.
What's 5 times 5 million? 25 yeah. million, right? And there we are. There's George's 20 million for the United States. In other words, their plan is, and this is part of the Georgia Guidestone thing that Jimmy Carter signed into... not law, but signed off on, right? Signed off on as a development of government in this country. And Jimmy Carter was the one who signed off on it. And it's all literally written in stone in the Georgia Guidestone. And if you, anybody can look online and see what it is. It's called the Plan 2000. And it's written in the Georgia Guidestones. And it's spelled out what the government is intending to do, and it includes depopulation, because they only need the cabal that is in charge right now all over the world is only planning on keeping alive enough people to service their needs and maintain a good state of the planet. And their excuses, things like global warming, green plan, environment control, and they use bodies like the EPA, the Sierra Club, the national parks, right? These are all for their personal pleasure. That's why they're preserving all this stuff. We as citizens can pay money and go and look at the national parks, but we can't actually live in them. We can't actually hunt in them. We can't actually spread ourselves out and enjoy ourselves. If we pay enough money to park our RV for a week, well, we can get to stay in them for a week. But then they tell you these are public lands, but we can't actually use them. They're set aside for the elite. That's who they're for, all of them. All the wilderness areas, all the national parks, these are all for the top 1 or 2% that own everything and own us. And they're going to reduce us. They're going to have, just I live in Montana, and every now and then the wildlife and game people have to go out and cull the elk herds because they eat themselves out of house and home and there's not enough food in winter for them. So they cull the herd. They cut it back to a manageable size. Well, that's what the government's planning on doing with us. In fact, it's what it is doing with us, with the introduction of diseases and then various viruses and then vaccines to cure them. It's culling the herd. That's what's going on right now. It's like, hey, open your eyes, people, and take a look around. We all been happy to live in this American dream, the great dream world, and it's just been one big illusion that government has created to make us blind, deaf, and dumb to the reality of what is being done with us and to us. And the next big step, because now they pretty well think they've got us under control and we won't argue, the next big step is signing off on the WF. Trudeau in Canada, the Prime Minister in Canada, Jason Trudeau, already signed off on it 2 months ago. He's already committed the state of Canada, the nation of Canada, to being part of this World Economic Forum and changing everything.
What did he do against the truckers union a few months ago in Canada? What was that all about?
Oh, he just basically shut them down. He shut off, as I understand it. He didn't touch the truckers. What he did was order the police to prevent anybody helping them. So they people, you know, there were hundreds of truckers in Toronto, and the local, and they come from all over the country. They come from America. Some of them had come up from Canada, from Mexico, I understand. And they come from all over America up into Canada. A protest against the government, and that was a protest against all the COVID, never take this, illegal jabs that have never been tested, and sticking untested drugs into your body. That's essentially what they were protesting. And local people in Toronto and Ottawa were bringing them food and water and handing it up to them in their trucks every day. They were coming like 24 hours a day. Local people were bringing them supplies so that they could continue to be there in their vehicles. And what Trudeau did, as far as I understand it, is he stopped all those people. He shut the roads and made the police prevent the people from helping the truckers. So after 2 or 3 days, you know, they had no access to food, water, or anything else. They had to give up and go home. They were driven out. They were forced out, starved out. Okay. It was like a siege.
Well, in the UK and in France and England, they're having problems right as we speak here today, September 17th, with energy. Listen to this.
It's unsettling, actually. Here's one example. Europe is descending into poverty. Did you know that? Had someone told you that? So the most advanced continent on the planet, the birthplace of Western civilization, our civilization, is getting much poorer very quickly. It's moving backward at high speed. Just a year ago, Europe was a modern place. For example, the overwhelming majority of Europeans heated their homes with natural gas, as modern people do. In Germany, the continent's richest country, only about 6% of households, most of them rural, heated with cordwood. And you'd expect that, given that, again, Germany is a modern industrialized country with central heating and indoor plumbing and all the other trappings of a society that has moved beyond the medieval period. Last year, only about 6% of Germans used wood to heat their homes, but that has changed dramatically. Demand for firewood in Germany has risen so fast that there is none left to buy. You can't get it. So desperate Germans are now cutting their own wood, scouring the forest like their ancestors for sources of heat. Watch.
Some in Germany are taking matters into their own hands, with solutions that might look like a blast from the past. About 2 hours outside Berlin, residents of this small town have turned to wood chips for fuel.
To other countries, it was a net exporter of energy. Now, there won't be enough heat in France for everyone in the country to stay warm. In the UK, 70% of restaurants are preparing to close, to go under. Why? Because when winter comes, they won't be able to afford to keep the heat and lights on, et cetera, et cetera. This is happening across Europe in every country. So the question is, why is it happening? And the answer is extremely simple. There's an energy shortage in Europe. Cheap energy is essential. It is the key to everything that a normal society strives for. Prosperity, safety, a longer life expectancy for its citizens, everything depends on cheap energy, but Europe no longer has it.
President Emmanuel Macron, Russia uses energy resources, like it does food, as a war weapon to exert pressure. Oil prices have doubled, coal prices have quadrupled, and natural gas is now 7 times more expensive than early last year.
7 times more expensive. So it turns out, if you don't have cheap natural gas, you can't run the continent. In minutes, that we cannot replace fossil fuels with renewables or green energy. And of course, they must have known that. When they told you otherwise, it was just posturing. It was childish and destructive fantasy talk that apparently fooled millions of their citizens. And
hemisphere, we are committed to maintaining our independence from the encroachment of expansionist foreign powers. It has been the formal policy of our country since President Monroe.
Oh, they're laughing.
We have green parties here in Europe. You have no idea what you're talking about.
Radically. You're no longer tempted to buy a new $1,400 iPhone or shop at Whole Foods or even pick up an extra cappuccino. The entire consumer economy grinds to a halt because there's no discretionary income. So it is impossible to overstate the downstream effects on the world of an energy crisis. Everything changes. How are the central banks responding to this? Not well. They seem to be making things worse on purpose. You know, in the United States, we're told not to notice what the Fed does because the Fed is now diverse and therefore great. Amazing piece in the AP just the other day announcing that, quote, leadership of the Federal Reserve has become its most diverse ever. There are more female, black, and gay officials contributing to the central bank's interest rate decisions than at any time in its 109-year history.
So it sounds like something is coming this way. Would you say that?
Yes. That's like the Stephen King book, you know, something coming this way, right? Definitely. And it's coming fast, and it's grim, very grim. It will be very, very unpleasant. And you see how they're floundering, you know, now the government has changed in Britain in that they've got a new prime minister, and she has put a two-year moratorium on prices for energy in the UK because the country was ready to do an uprising. They were, and they still haven't resolved everything, but as far as I know, the rail unions and the truckers along with them are planning on a strike, a general strike in the UK that it's the railway workers and the truckers union, and they are calling for a general strike in the UK because of the severe economic conditions there, where things are really bad. But again, it's a matter of what you've always had is what you expect to continue with. And certainly throughout my lifetime in Britain, well, in 1948, the healthcare service came in Britain. So throughout the whole of my life, almost, there has always been the National Health Service, which provides you with everything you could need, your glasses, your teeth, your doctors, your hospitals, everything you could need, and it doesn't cost you a dime. A medical bill is an unknown commodity in Great Britain and has been since 1948. So there is whole generations of people, two generations, my generation, the children and the grandchildren, three generations of people existing in Britain who have never known what it was to have a medical bill. Think of that here in America, never having a medical bill. They have also, since 1948, and Mr. Attlee's post-World War II government, they have always had a social security system which guaranteed that they were taken care of. If they were old and they'd been in a poor-paying job and they didn't have much social security money based on their earnings, the government made it up to them with cash allowances every week. Every week. If you had some injury where you were on crutches, no matter what your age was, the government gave you money every week because you couldn't do things while you were tied up with crutches. So you had to pay somebody for food or for cleaning your house or whatever. If you had a knee replacement that the government had paid for, they then also paid for you to have home help to look after you until you didn't need your crutches anymore. This is the system that three generations have lived with in Britain. And now, when the global situation is so dire because of the energy crisis, right, primarily in Europe due to Russia, because of that, they are absolutely freaking out. They don't know what to do with themselves because they can't pay their bills for electricity and their bills for all their utilities have gone through the roof. And the result, of course, is that the price of food also grown exponentially this last 2 years. I think grocery prices in the UK are up about 60% from 2020. So this is huge. And to people who were going paycheck to paycheck, life is impossible. No matter how hard they work, they're falling behind. They're getting in debt. And this is probably 60% of people living in England today are at this point in time getting into debt, where before, for their entire lives, they had managed to stay ahead of the game. And what is the big reason that they're falling into debt? Because in their entire lives, they've never had to worry about big things like healthcare, and therefore they had never been forced to save money. So they have no savings. Every penny they've earned, they've spent as they've earned it. And this is not everybody in Britain, but it's a lot of people. The majority, I would say, of working people live paycheck to paycheck and spend every penny they get because there had been no good reason to save it. And that is not true in America. When the energy crisis hits us, most people can keep paying their basic bills by sacrificing some of their other discretionary spending. But they also have been encouraged to save because we have no real health care here. People have to pay either big money to the insurance companies for health, or the government provides Medicare and they take a couple hundred dollars a month off you. Everybody, one way or another, pays for health care here in America. And that is such a big part of people's lives.
But England is having its problems.
Truss plans to address the energy crisis by capping energy bills at a cost to taxpayers of as much as $116 billion. Now, we expect to learn more about the plan on Thursday, but do you believe capping costs is realistic? And how will this affect citizens who are already struggling?
Well, of course, everybody's really struggling over there who is on the sort of the breadline. And the contention is those that say, do we want to burden our children and grandchildren with the ramifications of such a bailout? And then there are others who say, look, you know, the Second World War, it was only in 1986 that the UK finally paid back the US in terms of all the loans that were given to the Second World War. So it's a crisis. It's a war against energy. It depends which side of the aisle you're on. Some people want bailouts, some people want those subsidies, and others say, let everybody suffer. It just depends which side of the aisle you're on. But people are going to suffer regardless. It's a question of how much and how deep will this go.
So if that's happening in Europe, France and England and the UK, let's look at Venezuela. Yep. Let's look at El Salvador. How about Cuba? How about Peru? Peru just had an election, and people are in the street begging for food. I think it may come to the doorsteps of America if that continues. What do you think?
Oh, I'm sure it will. I think we're going to see, you know, soup kitchens and food lines again, just like they did in the Great Depression, because the energy crisis has to affect everybody. And, of course, this, look at who the profits go to. You know, when gasoline went up $5 a gallon recently, at the same time, I think it was Esso Oil Company. What's their name? Not Esso, the other big one, Exxon, right? Announced $10 billion of profits in the last quarter. Everybody's blaming the Ukraine war and the Russians and so on and so forth. And that is a problem for the gas for Europe because they get it from Russia. So they should have, you know what, people need to have the sense not to fall out with their neighbors, especially if their neighbors are providing essential goods for them that mean staying, not freezing to death in the winter. I don't really have a lot of sympathy with what's gone on in Europe generally and their energy problems because they've brought it on themselves with their own bad stupid, really stupid behavior. But it's also true that the energy companies and anybody who holds stocks in those energy companies over the last 20 years has been making a small fortune. The rest of the people now are going to suffer. So this, as that lady was just saying, it depends which side of the argument you stand on. Do you think it's okay for a few to make massive profits while the rest go hungry? Or do you think there should be some different system? And I think that right now, with the energy, I think that the oil companies who have made these big profits should, by law, have that money. Don't take it out of the taxpayer. Take it out of the oil companies themselves. Let them dump their billions of dollars into the system. Let them pay for the disaster that we're all facing now with energy. Why shouldn't they? If they take the profits when times are good, they should pay the bill when times are bad. I think that's reasonable. I don't.
Have you been keeping up with the Disclosure Project that Greer is talking about, Stephen Greer? Look, ladies and gentlemen, I think that people have to start doing their homework and prepare. Stephen Greer says the government of this country has the ability to give people electricity, dump all the oil and gas and all of that stuff, and they have the ability to provide all of this for the people, but it's being hid because the big boys don't want it. Like, if we go back to Tesla, Royal Rife, they developed systems that would provide care and energy and food, clothing, shelter, information, and medical care for all the people on planet Earth, but the big boys don't want that to happen.
That's when I realized in December 1993 that our country, the Constitution, the rule of law had completely run off the rails, at least in this specific area. And it was pretty much what Eisenhower, if you looked at the last speech Eisenhower made when he left office, when he said, beware the military-industrial complex, because it will become a threat if we're not careful to our democracy and our way of life. But that was his farewell speech. And this is a five-star general, World War II hero, of course, and a Republican. And no one really understood why he made that as his last speech. Well, it turns out one of his military guys who worked with him the last couple years of his administration was an old guy that I got to know, and was one of our Disclosure Project whistleblowers, said, oh, yeah, I was at the White House, and Eisenhower had been pushed aside and had lost control of those projects. So I think this is the part of the story that people have a hard time, in a sense, getting their minds around, because we all grew up with our history lessons and our civics lessons, and the president is the commander-in-chief and blah, blah, blah. In reality, the emperor has no clothes, and there are classified projects that go on, unfortunately, that are not supervised by the president or the Congress. So that led me with Daniel Sheehan to conclude that these projects were illegal. A priori, they cannot claim the rule of law to suppress testimony and disclosure of the subject. So we concluded that we could go forward with top secret documents and witness testimony and put it out to the public. And that's what we have been doing.
So in the words of Eisenhower, he said it this way.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
So how do we resolve that, the coming crisis?
How do we? I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't think that there is any way that we can on our own. I think we're going to need massive outside help. Unless it is possible that there are enough people like Dr. Greer. You know, Dr. Greer is an extremely learned man and very nice, as I remember. Unless we have a huge cadre of, I want to say, people, behind the scenes people who can step in as a new government for us. And I believe that, I don't know if you like what I'm going to say, but I believe that Mr. Trump is involved in this. I believe that his intentions were always in the best interest of the United States of America and the world generally. I believe that he was right to want to make a friend of Putin, because Putin, for all his faults, has supported the rise of a democratic government in Russia in a way which none of his predecessors ever did. And I think that Mr. Trump had a lot of connection off planet as well as on the planet. And I believe that behind the scenes, he is possibly involved in developing, if you like, a second government ready to step in and manage things when it all falls apart. Because you saw this with the French Revolution. They rebelled. There was a revolution. They chopped off all the aristocracy, all their heads. And then they had nobody left to manage anything because they didn't know how to do it. They had no manager. These are the ordinary people. And when they killed off, of course, we know the French Revolution was started by the aristocracy in the same way that the Russian Revolution was. But when you kill off all those people, you've got nobody of management capability left to run the planet. And somebody has to, you know, organize it and run things. So I think, I could be mistaken in this, but I think it's highly possible that Mr. Trump is involved in a program behind the scenes in preparation for taking over and stepping in, as it were, when the rest of it all falls down. I think that's who's going to fix it.
Okay. Well, we seem to be in trouble. Now that they're talking about the Pentagon and others in the government are now talking about extraterrestrials and UAPs and UFOs, and they're releasing some of the information. As a matter of fact, I just want to – here's a clip by Colonel Corso. He was in charge of that project from early on, from 1947 until he passed a few years ago, and he did write a book, and he said that in the book, The Day After Roswell, and I would – encourage people to get the book and kind of go through it. It's very simple. It's a nice book to read. Did you know Colonel Corso?
No.
But here's what he said.
And I'd add on to that. Give us information to the young people of the world in this country. They want to hear it. They want it. Give it to them. Don't hide it and tell lies and make stories. They're not stupid. They're not young men that'll panic. In fact, my own nephew is a research director of DACO Corporation. He tells me, his Uncle Phil, why don't they tell us the truth? We're not going to panic and pull our hair out. And one good example of this, which I always tell, to prove this point, that the young people will want it and they're not going to panic, they want to hear this. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this. Even my own grandchildren now will see it. And I always prove it this way. I commanded a battalion of 1,500 men, combat battalion. Average age of my soldiers was 19 and a half years old. I told my exec one day, my God, Maine were sending babies in the battle. And these kids, they fought the greatest armies in the world. They didn't run. They didn't panic. They stood there and fought. And why do you think they'll panic? They wanted this information. They deserve it.
And I think you said that the other day that all that information that the government has should be released to the public. Now, how do we get them to release the Dr. Sala, he talks about that often.
Yes. I think there are people like Dr. Sala and Dr. Greer and numerous other people who are taking the knowledge, and certainly George, you know, my George. I mean, that was why he started his publishing company in the first place, to take the material that whistleblowers were coming out with that was not popular and that other publishers wouldn't touch. So now, of course, we've got the development of all these, like Blog Talk Radio, these systems whereby we can disseminate information very quickly over large numbers of people, to large numbers of people, that it's now possible in a real sense to get the information out to everybody. Now we have to persuade people to actually hear the information, to read the information, and to take it in, to see what it means to them. And the last thing we want to do is get rid of this evil cabal and hand over to a bunch of extraterrestrials who are working with the Nazis under Antarctica. You know, we need to be careful who we are partnering with. Somebody once sent me a note. This was a young man who was psychically very gifted. And he sent me this little note. Yes, this is 50-odd years ago. And it said, "Dear Julian, I got a message to pass on to you last night. And the message said, flowers that are not grown in the earth are not to be trusted." That was all the message, right? Flowers that are not grown in the earth are not to be trusted. And I have never forgotten that little message. I keep it in the back of my mind all the time, because throughout history, it is extraterrestrials who have fed technological information to all the governments on the planet, right up to, you know, nuclear weapons. They have been fed by extraterrestrials, and they have been used not for our benefit, but to our detriment in almost every single situation. And right now, we know from Dr. Sala's books and other people's writings that under Antarctica, there is living and working the remains of Nazi Germany and the Third Reich. You might call the group the Fourth Reich. They have factories under there, which they transported from Germany at the end of World War II into the great caverns that are under the ice in Antarctica. They have, according to these researchers, 2,000 or more people as slave labor working in these camps. And the worst thing about it is that they're doing it in conjunction with the reptilian species. And the reptilian species are one of the most ancient in the universe, and they are 100% anti-human. They have nothing in common, nor any common goals, with humanity. They are truly an alien species, species that you will run across. You know, the ones you mentioned, Russ, like, you know, even the greys that are usually bad news, the greys, the silvers, the reticulans, the Pleiadians, the Sirians, all these different groups of people out there in space, they are all human. They might look a bit different, but basically they are part of the human family of species. The reptilians are true aliens in that they are not human. They have no connection whatsoever to humans. And that being the case, they are a dangerous species who will never have our best interests at heart. And they are currently working, as I said, with the former Nazis from Germany, from World War II, and groups of our military, certain parts of our army generals are working with them on the latest military technology as part of the military-industrial complex of the United States. I think we need to be very careful about that, and we also need to remember that down there sharing space with them are the Pleiadians. And the Pleiadians were to Germany and interacting with a group called the Vril Group even before World War II, feeding them military information, technological information that allowed them to build weaponry. So all these extraterrestrials we need to be very careful of, in my opinion. So, yes, we need disclosure. We need to know who they all are so we know what we're dealing with. And we need to know all their agendas. Absolutely. I have the same feeling about it as about the COVID jab. I don't think we should be given a COVID jab unless we know what the ingredients are in the prescription. I wouldn't take pills if I didn't know what they were made of. And I don't think we should take the COVID jab unless we know what's in it. And we don't, right? And I feel the same way about the extraterrestrials. We need to know what their agenda is.
Let me say this about the reptilians, and you know this. They have been here for thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, right? That's one. Two, they are extremely brilliant and deceptive. Shapeshift, in control of major industries across the whole broad spectrum of this planet. How do you get rid of that kind of person? How do you get rid of them? How do you coalesce with them to improve society is my question, if they were in control like that.
Well, I would say, first of all, if you are not using the products that they are making in the industries they control, they're not going to stick around that long because they're not making profit from it. My concern with the reptilians, see, the reptilians have no feeling, right? They don't hate humans, but they don't love humans either. They have no feeling about us. They don't care one way or another. Earth is simply a source of great profit for them, and that's what they're interested in. They are an interstellar star-hopping species. They have been for a long, long time. They are probably the most technologically advanced species in the universe. I think that may well be true. And I don't know for sure, but I think it's probably true because they travel throughout all star systems. And what they are predominantly is traders. They're like traveling salesmen. They're buying and they're selling all across the universe. Well, the great commodity, of course, that they have, that they can sell from Earth is people. It wouldn't surprise me if, you know, when George talked about gathering up the dissidents that are over 44 and sticking them in the FEMA camps, it wouldn't surprise me if the military then doesn't trade them off to the reptilians to be sold out in space. That sounds like crazy science fiction. But I think if anybody hears me say that, and I wouldn't have said it a few years ago because I don't want to be thought crazy, but if they read a few books that are out there today, and particularly the well-documented ones like Dr. Sala's work, then I think they will find that idea is not so crazy after all. And then that's probably what is happening right now to the thousands of people who go missing every year, that they are being picked up, abducted, handed, sold off by the cabal to the reptilians, and the reptilians are selling them across the galaxy. That, right, I think, is not far-fetched.
The answer to the problem is what, as we see it?
If I knew, I would fix the problem. But I don't see that we can fix it really until till humanity on this planet changes its perspective. Right now, about a third of the people on this planet have changed their perspective. They do accept the presence of extraterrestrials and of UFOs and of abductions and of all the things that you and I talk about. I would think that one in three or at least one in five people do accept that as reality. The other high percentage of people that don't accept it, well, until they change, and it's for me, if they, you know, end up in massive, terrible things on the planet, yes, it will be awful. And my heart breaks for everything that I know is coming to the people on this planet in the near future. It's going to be devastating and horrible to live through for so many who do live through it. Many won't. The majority will not live through what is coming down on this planet. The death rate is already soaring worldwide. And if anybody pays attention, I believe personally in the absolute reality of spirituality.
Okay.
And in order to understand that, you have to keep abreast of what's happening in this reality that we experience as living humans. You have to know what's going on. And that means checking sources, paying attention, you know, asking around, even going on the internet if you can't get it from anywhere else, right? Better than nowhere, even if it's not always right. Interestingly enough, there was a notice put out just about a week ago from, I think it was the World Health yeah, the WHO, the World Health, put out, they said it was, they were alarmed to see death rates soaring all across the planet. They weren't saying what was causing it or what was happening, just death rates in general are soaring. That was their words, not mine, right?
Yeah,
in the
right.
statement that they made.
Yeah, I got the report.
This is part of the reality.
But don't we have some benevolent, super duper dynamic, creative beings in the universe to come and help us? Don't we have that?
No. Here,
look, you said it this way.
Salvation is a doing
it will be known as
program.
The age of Tan. That's the future. And it will be under Chinese dominance, and it will be a form of global communism. And it will actually be a very good world because it will be based on the concept of, that are based in our, actually, in our constitution, equality, fair play, evenness, even-handedness, justice, you know, the things that are in our constitution. But we have never managed to actually live it. In America, we have the world's greatest document for the governance of man, and yet we don't live it. In communist China, they've gone through one of the worst periods probably in human history, like Russian communism, you know, where families and cultures were torn apart and just terrible, terrible situation. But if you can combine the two concepts of communal sharing, which is communism, communal sharing, under the auspices of a document like our Constitution, you will have as near utopia as you're going to get on this planet. And that is what is expected to come into play under the overshadowing of Marduk.
Okay, we have two minutes. So let's wrap it up. 2 minutes. Solutions.
2 minutes to set. 2 minutes to set the world right, right?
Yep.
Well,
yep.
Seriously. I think a very good place to start would be to start doing a little bit of meditation and a little bit of praying to your spiritual guides and helpers or angelic beings that watch over you, and start asking for a little help and guidance in directing our individual lives and getting back in touch with spirit. That's the most important thing we can do, because until we get in touch with our spiritual reality, we are not going to clearly know the best way forward for any of us.
So John 14:12, all the things that I have done, you can do and more, right?
Right. Absolutely. Okay. Christ was not joking when he said that. He meant it, and it's about time we jolly well started doing it.
So we have to get busy being in charge and taking control. Yes?
Yes. First of ourselves, then of our environment, and then of our nations.
Okay. Well, again, thank you very much. I think that Saving Jesus has a real poignant, actionable part in our lives in terms of what we need to do to save ourselves. So I really appreciate you being here to guide us in that direction. Appreciate it. Thank you very much once again for being with us.
Thank you.
And you have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you on Monday.
Thank you, Russell, and good weekend to you and everybody else.
Okay,
let's remember as we are primarily a Christian world, but whether we're in an Islamic world or Christian world, let us all remember our Lord's Day, whatever day that is, and keep it holy.
Okay, keep it holy. Thank you very much for being with us. Thank you.